The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make the show possible and check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. You may have seen the very exciting news this week that Ben de la Creme and Jinx Monsoon will release a holiday special in 2020, an adaptation of their wonderful live holiday show. I helped out with the shooting of the special, and without giving away too much, I can tell you it is going to be amazing. For this week's Sewers of Paris, we're jumping into the archives to revisit my 2016 interview with Ben de la Creme, a performer who specializes in breaking boundaries, upending order, and causing mischief. You probably know her best from season 6 of Drag Race, or the even more shocking All-Stars Twist season. If you enjoyed her on reality TV and at her live shows, just wait until you get to know Ben, the alter ego person behind the character. But first, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook, where I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode, and I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly livestream on September 25th at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link at the top of The Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And don't forget to check out my other shows, Culture Cruise on YouTube for a deep dive into queer entertainment milestones, and Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two narrative comedy podcasts with drag heroes going on adventures in a world of fantasy. Now, speaking of fantasy, here's Dayla.
Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. I'm joined by performer Ben de la Creme. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So, what is the entertainment that changed your life?
My origin story is largely based in the cartoons that I watched growing up. Chuck Jones, Tex Avery have a pretty big influence on my current loves and tastes and performative mannerisms. I also was really kind of crazy about anything else that had a lot of those same qualities. Pee-wee's Playhouse was super fascinating and terrifying to me as a child, but like I was that attraction repulsion, couldn't look away kind of thing. And now as an adult, I just think Paul Rubens is a genius. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite, like when you think back to classic Looney Tunes, do you have a favorite gag or a favorite character, or like when you're recommending them, like what's one of your favorites?
I mean, I think Duck Amuck is maybe the best. Am I thinking the right one? So the Duck Amuck, I believe, is the one where Daffy Duck gets in a fight with the artist, and then the artist is like erasing and redrawing the surroundings and then the costuming.
Buster, it may come as a complete surprise to you to find that this is an animated cartoon, and that in animated cartoons they have scenery, and in all the years I... All right, wise guy, where am I?
It's bizarre and it's surreal, and it's all these just very weird out there ideas, but the internal logic is so strict and the storytelling's really simple, and it's... I mean, that's one of my super favorites. And then I always loved the really epic ones, like, What's Opera Doc? Like, all the ones where, you know, Bugs and Elmer would do, or, like, Barbara Seville, or, like, you know, any of those.
I've probably watched What's Opera Doc, like, frame by frame.
Yeah.
There's such beautiful expression in that. Like, just the horse, you know, that giant fat horse.
Oh, my God, it's so beautiful. Yeah, with those flowing locks. And I forget sometimes that I did this, but once upon a time at ACT Theater for a cabaret, Ernie von Schmaltz and I just did What's Opera Doc. We just took that sound from the entire cartoon and just performed the cartoon as closely as we could, being actual humans.
Return, my love, a longing burns deep inside me.
Return, my love, I want you always beside me.
Love like ours must be.
It was very fun. And we got to do it in that cabaret space. So we were using like the big descending staircase to make the grand entrance once, you know, Bugs gets into the braids. And I feel like that span of grandness, I don't know, the jokes seem really dumb, but they're so complicated. I mean, you have to have this kind of sense of childlike innocence to come up with humor as basic as like somebody getting hit in the face and their teeth turning into piano keys. You know, like that's, it's really, it seems simple, but it's really, it's hard to get into a mind frame where you can imagine things like that.
What's the one with, Mark Antony, the dog, that giant dog and the little kitten?
Yeah.
I've forgotten the name of it, but there's that beautiful cartoon where it's just, there's almost no dialogue. There's just like one of those, headless humans where you only see them from the waist down.
Right.
And, you know, it's like the housewife and she's yelling at the dog for bringing a kitten in the house. And it's just so lovely.
Yeah. And there's that affection between the two of them. And there's that, right. I very distinctly remember that thing of the tiny kitten sort of kneading around in the dog's flesh and making a little nest for himself and the dog like reacting to the claws and being upset, but then like moving through its physical discomfort to be like nurturing. Oh, it's really.
Yes.
Oh, is that the same one where the little cat is like walking off all the I-beams, or is that like a sequel?
No, that's a sequel. That's okay. Where the cat's like out in the world and Mark Antony has to like rescue it from all these ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's very, what's the character from Tiny Toons?
Well, Tiny Toons was such a great reimagining of all of those wonderful tropes. I mean, it was really such a great homage, but it was Mindy? No. The baby had like a blonde triangle hairdo,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And then the dog was like a red
pickles,
dog.
Pickles, right? Pickles or bubbles?
Buttons! Oh, buttons! Silly puppy.
Oh, God, I love that. Tiny Toons was another just, like, amazing. Tiny Toons, Animaniacs, that kind of weird Warner Brothers renaissance that happened right mm-hmm. in that moment. I mean, because there really was sort of a lull after that classic era of Looney Tunes. And then, I mean, I feel very fortunate to have had humor geared towards kids. It was actually really, I mean, there was a lot of really intelligent stuff happening there.
Yeah.
And it was also sort of an introduction to, I mean, you wouldn't think kids need an introduction to classic Looney Tunes, but there is something about, like, there was a sense of humor there that was, like, a little bit, it was just a specific language, and so it was nice to have all of us youths of the 90s kind of reintroduced.
No, it was a great gateway. And, you know, and even Pee Wee Herman, I mean, that's a show with, like, you watch it as a kid, and you're like, oh, Del Rubio, whatever, and, you know, who? So many strange guests on the holiday special.
Oh, yeah.
Charo, oh, sure, why not?
Grace Jones. Delivered in, like, a box to Pee-wee's place. She was supposed to be delivered at, right? What's the plot? She's supposed to be delivered
to the White House.
The White House. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
It's Grace Jones.
Wait a minute. You're not the president. You're Pee-wee Herman.
Duh.
This package was supposed to go to the White House, not the Playhouse.
Sorry, Grace. Back in the box.
Since I'm already here, would you mind if I sang a song?
No, go right ahead. What are you waiting for, Christmas?
Oh my God. I mean, the Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special is...
Oh, and Frankie and Annette? Or just like making his Christmas cards.
Oh yeah, and miserable about it. Super upset that they have to make these Christmas cards and just being put to work. I mean, Pee-wee's Playhouse was always an amazing TV show, but that Christmas special really, like, so many things crystallize in it, and
it has this feeling of like, oh well, I guess Duck Amuck has the same thing of like rule breaking, and this isn't supposed to happen this way, but we're doing it.
Right. Yeah. Well, and this very specific internal logic, like this idea that you might not know the rules of this universe, but you're safe because the people in the universe know the rules
right.
of the universe.
You right. Know? Yeah. No. Everyone loves Pee-wee.
Yeah.
And there's this consistency.
Yeah.
Somehow, it's like you know, when someone says I don't know, you know that they're gonna have water dumped on their head.
That was slime.
Slime,
right?
Was it slime? Oh no, you're right. It was water, and somebody would have water dumped on their head. I don't know. Was slime.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I forgot about the water.
Yes,
it was the less interesting substance.
Yeah, exactly.
The time.
So, what did I mean? Were you watching this stuff as a kid growing up? Did you have friends who liked it?
Well, I didn't have a lot of friends. But I, was, I was a real loner as a kid, but I would obsessively watch this stuff. I mean, and it sort of spans for the ages, right? Like, I mean, when I was really young, of course, I grew up watching Looney Tunes and stuff on TV, but I don't think I really had a huge attachment to them until later when I sort of like came back in my preteen, early teen years, and then was like, oh, there's something here that really speaks to me that I sort of had to come back to. I mean, also the queerness in all of those things. I mean, Miss Yvonne is clearly a drag character. Mm-hmm. I mean, all these things that I was super into as a kid, like going back later, I'm like, oh, there's, it's really like they were speaking to me in this language that I didn't know was my language.
Yeah.
But I still understood the language at the time.
Sure. Yeah. They're like training kids for camp.
Yeah.
Don't worry, kids. You'll get it later on. You'll understand camp later on.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, I mean, similarly with Bugs and Drag and, you know, a lot of those similar kind of, I mean, those cartoons have a big camp sense, but I mean, it's this kind of broad humor that is really, I think, speaks to a gay aesthetic. Surprised I don't hear about it being talked in that way more often.
Yeah, yeah. No, it comes up every now and then. Someone will mention like, oh, Bugs in a Dress.
Right.
Which is like fascinating that it's never like, haha, ugly Bugs in a Dress.
Right.
It's hot Bugs.
Yeah,
it's like totally seductive, shaking his hips.
Yeah.
What's the one, there's that cartoon where he's in a department store and there's like this, the department store detective, the house detective is chasing him and he hides in the like the shoe department in like this red dress and a blonde wig and asks to see something in a high heel.
A customer. Good evening, miss.
I'd like to see something nice in a pair of bedroom slippers.
Confidentially, so would I.
That's right. I'd forgotten about this. Yeah, no, I mean, I have a vague recollection of it, but...
And he's always... they're always seduced. Right. You know, the man is always seduced by Bugs.
Right.
There's that fascination with the feminine wiles.
Oh, totally. Well, and even the characters that aren't, like, Bugs in Drag. I mean, like, Red Hot Riding Hood, that, you know, like, the like her performing and that, like, glittery onesie and the wolf going insane. There's this sort of... I don't know. I mean, it's so crazy and she's so over the top and her movement is so like elasticized and rubbered that it's, you know, it feels very related to this kind of hyper feminine shticky drag queen business.
We now give you our brand new little sweetheart of swing, that little red-headed ball of fire, Red Hot Riding Hood.
Daddy, I want a diamond ring, I want some bracelets and everything. Daddy, you better get the best for me.
Looking back, did you have what you would think of now as like a queer sensibility as a kid? Like, was this something you were internalizing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I was always very, I mean, I was a very gay kid from a very young age, you know, it was the thing where like, apparently when I was, you know, 3 or 4, my parents were kind of talking about what they were going to do about this, you know, which, you know, I mean, luckily my parents were really amazing and what they were going to do was be fine with it, but they had to figure that out, you know.
What did that look like? Like, what was the gay 3 and 4 year old Ben?
Well, one thing, I mean, I don't remember that age that specifically, but I do remember, I think it must have been, I was like in first grade when Who Framed Roger Rabbit came out, which is another terrifying movie that I was also completely drawn to, but we saw that in the theater. And I remember, I mean, I begged my parents to see this movie in a theater. And I think that the big, my memory of what drew me to it most was the, I think it was a McDonald's commercial where Jessica and Roger like go through a drive-thru and Jessica's like drinking a big, you know, cup of soda or whatever. And I remember seeing her. I mean, first of all, what happened to commercials like that? That's like a high budget commercial. I wish that we, but anyway, they're going through the drive thru and Jessica Rabbit like reaches her like long purple gloved arms out to like grab the like food or whatever. And I just remember being so smitten with her, and that was the thing that made me have to go see this this movie. Again, same as Red Hot Riding Hood, which is, of course, part of what she's based on. There's, you know, it's this, she has this sort of command over space. It's very sort of, I mean, it's very feminine. It's not, there's no way that you can talk about her as being, like, masculine at all. But there's, you know, this way in which this femininity is suddenly powerful in a way that, as a feminine kid, I'm not seeing examples of this. I'm not seeing that femininity can have any power. But anyway, how was I a feminine kid? One example is that after Who Framed Roger Rabbit, it was the late 80s, early 90s, I was wearing those big oversized t-shirts that were in vogue in the day. And so what I found out was very easy to do was to stretch the collar of my shirt over my arms and under into my armpits to create a strapless dress. So I would, as soon as I was left to my own devices in school, I would make my, you know, giant, like, tie-dye, peace sign, smiley face Spencer's gift shirt into a beautiful, glamorous strapless dress. And once you have a strapless dress, you, of course, need to have the walk for a strapless dress. You know, you really need to, like, be able to swing your hips when you walk. You need to work on your arm mannerisms. So all of these things really started to manifest heavily. And I remember, you know, a few times my mom sort of being like, all right, you know, I just am really worried about, you know, and it was really more about my safety, you know, than anything else. She was like, you know, a first grader who's like doing these kind of mannerisms. I think she was concerned about what would happen to me. But I didn't. I was baffled and angered and incensed about the fact that I would somehow not be encouraged to saunter as hard as I possibly could everywhere I walked. But
how did the other first graders receive this drag routine that you're putting together?
I mean, honestly, I don't think anybody my age gave a shit. You know, like, I remember very specifically a few boys in my class being like, oh, you gotta do that, you gotta show this person, oh my god, Ben does the best Jessica Rabbit. Like that, you know? So it's... I was also in a Montessori school at the time, so that is a lot of context. Once I started going to public school in fifth grade, suddenly the floor dropped out from under me, and I was not as well received. Mm-hmm.
Sounds like you're sort of performing just, you know, to people around you at that point.
Very much so, or to myself. And I remember very distinctly expressing to my parents about the fact, like, was it normal to feel like there was always someone in the room with you? Like, I very much had this feeling of always being looked at as a kid. And I think that comes out of being sort of othered. And so feeling like in public, I was constantly being scrutinized and sort of internalizing that. Because I don't feel like that in my adult life. I'm actually much more introverted and introspective than I ever thought I would grow up to be. But yeah, when I was a kid, I would put on shows in my room for no one. Like, I would, you know, line up my stuffed animals on the table, and I really distinctly remember doing an Easter pageant with all these stuffed rabbits I had, and, you know, performing it not to myself, but to the wall. And what I do now as a performer seems like a really natural extension of that, but yeah. I no longer am driven to just do it for no one in my bedroom, but I kind of wish I were. Because that seems like the same kind of insane, you know, thing that you have to have in your brain that produces things like we were talking about in the Looney Tunes. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I mean, you have to have a screw loose in order to connect to these ideas in these ways. Now, sometimes I find myself like laboring over figuring out, like, okay, what's the right next thing to happen in the sequence of events in this show. And I'm just like, I try to tap into whatever weird part of me was, mm-hmm. Just letting it flow.
As a kid.
Yeah.
When I was young, and whenever anything interesting happened or something, like I noticed something, I would start to narrativize it in my head and like write as though I was writing like my memoirs for the day.
Yeah.
And write it down in my head. Like, and then he said.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to also, like, I never just listened to music. I always was you know, and it's interesting now because this is still my relationship to music, is I always was imagining what would be happening to that music. Mm-hmm. And I would sort of, you know, have a cast of characters in my head. And then I'd be like, you know, okay, so this beat is like anvils falling on these horses. And I mean, it was all like nonsense, but it was that same kind of, it was like choreographing or something.
Yeah.
These nonsense scenes.
Were you, tell me more about the shows that you would put on just as a kid. Like, what were you performing?
Well, what was I performing? Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I don't know. Like, weird. I mean, I would, like, put on newscasts for no one about what was happening in the house, you mm-hmm. know. And once I got a video camera as a kid, which I think I got around 12, I started doing a lot of, like, I don't know where any of these tapes are. None of them exist anymore. But I remember, like, doing a lot of parodies of things. I remember setting up Playmobil guys on a thing and, like, dragging bacon through the scene and making roaring noises for Jurassic Pork, you know? It was, like, dumb shit like that. I used to also force people around me to be in things and then put on shows for our parents. I mean, my cousins who were like not inclined to do this stuff at all. It wasn't like a collaborative effort. I was like, okay, we're doing this thing. We all work in a hospital, but we're fish. You're a seahorse and you're a surgeon. And I'm a, and they were like nonsense things, but then it was very bossy. It carried over.
Were you performing in like actual shows? Like, did you ever get up on a stage?
Not until, I started to in school when that became an option. You know, I think my first role on a stage was I was the emperor in The Emperor's New Clothes. And I was mortified because I had to be in my boxers in front of everybody. And then I think I played a jaguar in some play about the, you know, ruining of our rainforests.
Oh, okay. Very timely.
Yeah.
Was that at the Montessori school?
This was at the Montessori school. Yes. So I was very inclined toward all of that stuff, but I was also, I did a lot more visual art than I did theater stuff in school and just kind of, you know, cartoons and that whole world, like comic strips. I did a lot of comic strips as a kid and that was kind of more where my public artistic expression lay. And I never do that stuff anymore, but it really, I feel like it's all kind of adds up to the same thing. Mm. It was easier to organize characters on a page.
Sure. Yeah. You're putting together a story.
Right.
So you mentioned that when you went to, in fifth grade, you went to a public school and that changed things for you. What changed?
Oh God. In my prior school experience, I wasn't like cool or popular by any means, but you know, there certainly is, at least at that Montessori school, they very effectively sort of created it was a more even playing field. You know, there really wasn't, you know, I didn't have a sense of that food chain in the same way as when I started in a public school. And it just hit me really good. I mean, it was like on the first day, it was like, I mean, children are terrifying, horrible creatures, really. It was just immediately made super clear how, like, weird and freakish and, like, just unacceptable I was. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, here's where you're going to be in the scheme of this world. And this is how we're going to treat you and just expect this for as long as you're here. Yeah, I mean, I fell on very difficult social times for quite a few years at that point.
Where was that?
This was in Litchfield, Connecticut.
Oh,
yeah.
For heaven's sake, I grew up in Southington, Connecticut.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Oh.
I know. Oh, Connecticut.
Oh. Yay. How was Southington?
Oh, similar.
Yeah. After I left, I realized I had always been raised to think that New England was actual America and the rest of the country was sort of this weird, embarrassing growth, mm-hmm. you know?
Like, yeah. Well, there's so much density. There's so many states just like crammed together in there that you've got. It feels like a country. New England feels like a country.
Well, and there's a weird sense of pride of it being the original, mm-hmm. you know, like, I mean, it's bizarre how much Plymouth Rock was brought up in conversation in my childhood.
Oh my God. Yes. And the Constitution Oak and Old Saybrook? No, Old Sturbridge. Old Sturbridge Village.
Yeah.
And all the mystic stuff.
Yeah.
Pilgrims everywhere.
Very weird. And I mean, my grandmother was a member of a society called the Daughters of the Mayflower. And this was women who could trace their heritage back, you know, who could like provide the documentation to say that somebody came over on the Mayflower. And my mother, who was adopted, was never permitted to go to Daughters of the Mayflower meetings, but her sister, who was not adopted, was. It was really intense.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. But that is the New Englandest thing I've ever
heard. Yes. Yeah. No, very much so.
So, okay. So we both have similar high school experiences.
Yes.
You know, okay, this is what's popular and this is what's trendy right now. And it's the mid-90s, and if you're a weird theater kid...
I mean, people recognized that I was skilled in the arts, but that didn't help you. You know, that it was something that was sort of, you know, the other kids sort of universally recognized that I was really good at X, Y, and Z, but those things had no value, so it didn't change anything. You know, I could get the lead in the school play, and everyone could think I was great, but that didn't mean I wasn't going to get beat up in the hallway the next day. Yeah, and then I still just had such an affinity for these same weird things, and I just didn't know how to cap it. Like, I was never somebody who knew how to shut up and blend in. Like, I dressed very eccentrically I never didn't. Sort of my love of all of this kind of nonsense. You know, I was the only boy in my grade who had the Backstreet Boys binder. You know, like, it was... And I didn't know how not to do that. And all of my English assignments would be like these weird sort of narratives, and we'd have to read them in class, and everybody would think I was a total freak. And I remember very specifically how much people like me were told at that age, oh, you're doing this because you want attention. You're trying to stick out. And I was like, holy crap, I can't, how could you possibly think that I want this attention, you know? And when I got sort of more out into the world and discovered that there were just other people who were actually like me, it was like, and none of us really want that much attention. We just want to be around each other, you know?
Did you ever feel like actually physically unsafe? Like, were you threatened or were you actually ever attacked?
Yeah, I was threatened a lot growing up. I was beat up a lot, but never super badly. But definitely I was very concerned about my physical safety a lot growing up, and was, you know, in that, I don't know what your school was like, but I, you know, things would happen with other students. I would be threatened or hit or whatever, and I would go to my vice principal, who would tell me, or my dad would go to my vice principal, who would really say, well, we're going to need you to tone yourself down if you don't want to expect that anymore. Yeah. And I got that from a lot of teachers as well. It was a dark time, and I'm not sure that, I mean, I would have made it through. My dad luckily had the good sense to see that and pulled me out right before senior year, and I completed my high school time at a school for the arts in Massachusetts, and that was the most insane culture shock of all, because I went from being completely reviled for all of these qualities to actually being, you know, as opposed to Montessori, where it's all sort of everybody's level, I was actually one of the cool kids. It was very weird. And it was like a complete flip. And it was just because of all of these weird loves that I didn't know how to stop.
Suddenly you're like, oh my God, I'm a star.
Yeah. You know, and then it took a few years to like tame the ego blossomed out of that. But,
so what kind of performance did you do at the art school?
Well, I did my very first public drag performance.
Wow.
Actually.
How did that go?
It was received really well. It was, I did two public drag things. I did me and a couple, my two roommates, so this was a boarding school. I mean, it was a boarding school for the arts, first of all, is the most ridiculous thing in the world. Like, I was in a boys' dorm that was essentially... The separation of genders ceases to make any sense in this context. I lived in a room with two other gay men all of a sudden. I guess we were children, really. But so anyway, I forced both of them to play the other two roles in Gotta Have a Gimmick. And we did Gotta Have a Gimmick for like a school talent show. And that, I think, was my first drag on stage in front of anyone. And then I did a... I just did like a recital. I got one of the music kids to play piano for me, and I did like a cabaret act. You know, the teachers came out, and it was not, you know, the kids were weird and eccentric, but everybody was very nurtured in that. But I didn't know any other drag kids doing drag there at that time. I'm sure I was not the first and was not the last. But so all the students came out, all the teachers came out. I mean, I just got to fill this little room that was sort of off the library with people and, you know, do this. I mean, it was my first sort of bumbling through what a cabaret act might look like, but it was amazing. I mean, it was suddenly like, oh, okay, this is my trajectory. And then I graduated, moved to Boston for a year before I went off to school. And that was the first time I ever saw Varla Jean Merman. Was I moved to Boston and I went to her Christmas show, Holiday Ham, just because I like saw a poster for it and I was like, this looks like something I want to see. And that was the moment that I was like, oh, there's a place for me in the world, not just as a human, but professionally. Like, there's something I can do with my life that is a job I would want. Because I'd always been like, what the hell kind of job would I ever want to have? All y'all have boring ass ways of making money.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. What am I going to do with myself in these diaphanous robes and things right. that I want to wear?
Yeah.
What? So for folks who have shamefully not encountered Varla, explain what sort of performer she is.
She's brilliant. I mean, she encompasses all these things I'm talking about. She's a drag performer, but I mean, I still think that unfortunately that phrase does not fully communicate to people what that thing can be. You know, it's the way that when you say painting to some people, they picture oil landscapes. You know, I mean, Varla is, first of all, an incredible singer. She has this operatic range that is just out of control, and a brilliant writer, and she just does these. I mean, the first show I ever saw her do was this Christmas show, and it was all over the place. There were no rules. She's gorgeous, but she's not afraid to look ugly. She's not afraid to just go for whatever the right laugh is in that moment, and there doesn't need to be. I mean, she can break logic for periods of time just to go. I mean, it's similar to Paul Rubens, you know, it's just whatever is the most satisfying moment at that moment is kind of what she does.
Oh, hello. I'm Varla Jean Merman. And it's that time of year again where we reflect on the generations of gender illusionists who laid the foundation, by applying one, for such drag performers as Divine, RuPaul, and Bea Arthur.
It's just sort of this thing where anything could happen, but we know what the rules are. She knows the rules, and so we're safe in her hands. And I think that first show I watched her, I think it opened with her coming on the stage and singing in this beautiful falsetto Ave Maria while she just held a burning candle and was in sort of like a long flowing robe and then drops the candle and starts to stomp it out and go, Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ, as she's trying to stomp out the flame. And that was the beginning of this show in which she sang You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch, and pulled inflatable Christmas trees out of her skirt. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So she did a whole segment on the guys Rankin and Bass. Okay, so she did a whole segment on them and how
the Christmas special.
Yeah, yeah. And apparently one or both of them was Jewish. Oh, and so she did. That. She did a whole bit about that where she's using like slides and talking about that. I mean, she's weird and brilliant and smart and is best known for Girls Will Be Girls, the film, which she is incredible in. But she. If that's all you know about her, you're like missing a ton about her. She's really worth checking out. And I think so. Now we get to work together in P-Town. We're not doing the same show, but P-Town is such a small town, and she performs at the theater 20 feet from the theater that I've been performing at. We first met years ago. She came to see the Atomic Bombshells when I was performing there with Kitten LaRue. Lou Henry Hoover is not part of it yet, but
and that's the cabaret troupe that
it's the burlesque troupe that I perform in here and in Provincetown with. But she came to see the show. I mean, I was just like, I was more nervous. I don't think I've ever been as nervous to meet somebody as I was to meet her. I was just so in awe of her as a creative force in this genre that really is just constantly being reinvented. I mean, I think one of the downsides to Drag Race, the phenomenon, I mean, the popularity of drag and the widespreadness of it is amazing, but suddenly there's like, oh, drag is this and this and this. And like, even though there were some assumptions about oh, drag queens are just men in dresses lip syncing to whatever. There was a huge, if you really knew anything about drag, there were no boundaries. So people just were inventing it constantly. And now I think the challenge is going to be moving forward to figure out how to keep inventing what the rules of drag will be, as opposed to, because now we have so many points of reference. But, what rabbit hole did I just go down? What am I talking about?
We got here because you were in Boston. You saw Varla.
Oh, right. But I do want to say that Varla is, I now get to work together in Provincetown, and she's amazing. And we get to, like, we started having lunches together. And then I just got back from staying for a week at her place in New Orleans, which was the most surreal moment of my adult life. Was Lady Bunny called me on my cell phone while I was sitting in Varla's house to chat about something. Like, it was, these are my idol. Like, it was crazy. But yes, so Varla in Boston, the beginning of my career as a drag queen.
Yeah, so how did that, what was your persona like at the time?
Well, at the time I was just, I hadn't gotten very far. I think I think the thing that happens to most gay boys when they put on drag for the first time is related to that thing that we see in Jessica Rabbit when she gets on the stage and everyone falls silent and there's so much control. It's this power reversal where if you are an effeminate gay person who has been constantly told they're less than, and suddenly you're a beautiful woman, even though clearly male privilege trumps what goes on with women in our world, there's a power difference that you suddenly feel. And I think it rushes to most gay boys' heads and they manifest as bitchy. Their first thing is they get kind of drunk with power, and they're kind of, I think that kind of like bitchy catty drag queen, I think that's the first fallback. And that was true for me too. I know a lot of, which is funny now because my character has become the inverse of that. I think sort of as a slow response to that. I remember the people who encouraged me when I first got into drag were like, you're really great at this. You look great. You've got presence, but you're really mean. And at the time I didn't even see it. But so that's kind of how it started. And then when I moved to Chicago, I started performing. So I went to school in Chicago at the Art Institute, and then met some local performers who were drag kings, the Chicago Kings, and there were a few like burlesque girls in that troupe as well. And at the time I wasn't 21, and so they were super organized, as lesbians tend to be, and they had worked something out where their underage performers could like actually get into the venues legally and perform. And so one of the drag kings that I went to school with was also my age. And so he was like, oh, you should come and do this with me. And so suddenly I was exposed to not only this, I was having like a fine arts education, which was expanding my mind, but I also suddenly was rolling with like a lot of really radical queers with like something to say in their performance. And I had been really into like punk music in my teen years and sort of going to all those shows because that was sort of the refuge. That kind of changed through rage. It was very much what I identified with at that time. So,
Were you angry? Did you feel like an angry person?
Oh, I was so angry. I had such a crazy temper. When I first started doing drag sort of in a more official sense in Chicago, I started like creating one name for myself and trying to create a cohesive look. My name was Tina Angst, and I was a riot girl. And I was like, and it was all like, it's a very common look now, but it was all like, pink and black dreadlocks and like pleather mini skirts and the bondage boots and all the rest of it.
Wow, that is fascinatingly different from the Ben that I know today.
Yeah. No, and that's where I started. And all my performances were to like La Tigra and Bikini Kill and that kind of stuff. And also it was kind of an angry response to the fact that I was trying to find my place as a drag queen, and all I could find in terms of places where drag was being performed, and this was kind of before I met the Chicago Kings, was clubs where everyone looked so generic. Like, all the gay men had the same crew cut and the same t-shirt, and all the queens were in sequin. You know, and I love this kind of drag as well. You know, like, I really... But I was like, everyone is a pageant queen here, and there's no place to do... You know, and it wasn't that... I necessarily started being like, I want to be this punk thing, but I was mad that I couldn't find space to do anything else. And so it kind of turned into that. And then it was just kind of a slow morphing. You know, I started, like, that was kind of the first couple of years, and then it slowly started turning into this different thing. I think I became aware of attracting flies with honey instead of vinegar kind of idea. Mm. And I still feel like most of those ideas and philosophies are still the undercurrent of what I do. It's just manifested in a different way.
Yeah, well, I suppose, like, I'm thinking to the show that I just saw you in, the 4th of July show.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, I very deliberately was like, nobody tell me what the show is. I want to go in fresh. And so I was really not expecting that. It is a really sensitive critique of patriotism.
Yeah.
Not just like, you know, we need to feel ashamed about this, but it's a really intelligent look at why do we experience patriotism? What does it do for us? It is as emotionally complex as any Looney Tunes, or, you know, there's like, you know, you go in thinking, oh, we're going to hear some songs and see some lip syncing. And it really, like, it's really quite moving.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And I think we all strived to be in that same language. That was the first show that I made with Kit LaRue and Lou Henry Hoover. It was sort of an interesting series of events that sort of, or just a series of conversations, really. I think of the three of us, Lou has the most sort of personal experience with his idea of patriotism, having family in the military and lots of personal experiences that stem from that. It sort of rose, I think, initially it was Kit and I saying, we want to do something with that crazy bicentennial aesthetic and have like a chorus line of George Washington's or something insane. And then, you know, starting to talk to Lou about his personal experience and then exploring a lot of our own ideas about like, okay, why do we even have a relationship? Like, why do we care about this imagery? And so my character in that show, I think, you know, it's basically looking at all those same things as being like, hey, let's talk about this. But, you know, when I was in my early 20s, it would have been me yelling at you about it. And now I tend to align myself with, or I tend to align my character with whatever I'm trying to critique. So I actually make her sympathetic to whatever it is that we want to talk about. And that is actually a much easier tool to communicate through.
Mm, mm-hmm. Yeah. You're doing sort of a devil's drag advocate.
Yeah.
Was there like a transition? Was there a time when you realized, oh, I'm kind of setting aside this, it was Tina Angst was the,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm kind of setting aside the angst of Tina Angst. And so I think of modern Ben de la Creme as being a very convivial host.
Mm.
Hostess of, you know, someone who makes people comfortable.
Yeah.
And that's, they're so separate. Like, was there a transition, like,
well,
when you realized?
I started to get, I mean, just because people were interested in what I was doing in Chicago, I started to get people asking me to host events and do things like that. And so I started to do things where I was, you know, not thrashing around to Riot Grrrl music, but was, like, actually interacting with people. And I really liked it. And I really liked starting to speak, like, find a character who wasn't me, that, you know, because also I, at the time, was very shy and didn't feel very comfortable in a lot of social situations. So having a character to speak through sort of allowed me to do that. And I also started to find that, oh, right, like, I'm upset about these rifts in the community. You know, there's a very long history of drag being a tool used to help to bring folks together and to, you know, be sort of a beacon of a place to find solace. You know, I mean, if you're looking at, you know, drag queens, you know, lurking in the shadows in decades prior, and, you know, if there's a queen performing somewhere, you know that this is a place we can band together and feel safe. And in some way, there's a maternal role in that, no matter who she is or how she's behaving, you know. So I think I started to become interested in that idea of, it felt like it was beginning to solve one of the problems I was so mad about. Mm. And so I still had the name, but the look and the voice started to shift and develop as I just interacted with people more and realized that it was making me happier than being angry. Yeah, that was kind of the beginning of that evolution.
How'd you wind up in Seattle?
I just wanted to leave Chicago. Chicago's a great city and there's a lot of amazing things happening and I met a lot of amazing people, but it never felt really like home to me.
And those winters.
Yeah. Oh, wait. And the summers. I mean, honestly, it's two terrible temperatures with no seasons in between. And so I was already pointed west, so I just figured I'd keep going. I'd always had sort of dreams of what the West Coast could be, you know? I mean, I think a lot of, you know, weirdos and artists and queer kids growing up on the East Coast sort of had this, like, fantasy. The way that I was talking about New England being sort of, you know, I'd always heard, you know, California, the West Coast was always talked about in this disparaging, like, oh, those crazy hippies and art. And I was like, oh, cool, I want to know about those people. But I'd never been. I had some different friends who had moved from Chicago to various... I had friends in Portland, Seattle, in San Francisco, and so I decided to go visit all those cities and then just pick the one I liked best, which was Seattle. I just had a really great experience here, and move there, and if I didn't like it, I'd move somewhere else. But, you know, I went from working, like, 4 jobs in Chicago trying to work it out to, within a year of being here, I had a full-time job as a performer, and I was like, oh, this is a place for me.
It is remarkable, like, the performance scene in Seattle. This was something that I wasn't expecting when we moved here, but it's so robust.
Yeah. You know, I don't have certainly there's, like, a lot of history. I don't have any sort of personal sense of what it was before I got here, but I definitely had that sort of electric feeling when I got here and still do. But, I mean, I feel like I just, especially for cabaret, burlesque, cabaret, drag, this sort of hybrid, I got here at this insane time where just all these things were mounting and sort of culminating and coming together. The Atomic Bombshells, Shardana and Lou at the time were working together as a duo, Waxy Moon, Indigo Blue sort of starting this. I mean, she was the first person I met her in Chicago performing and, you know, sort of knew that she ran the Academy of Burlesque out of here. There was just so much happening and there was so much crossover. It was like we had, my first job was at the Can Can Cabaret and that was Rainbow Fletcher, who is just an insane modern dance choreographer, contemporary dance choreographer, who's, you know, super respected and branching out in all directions now. But at the time she was just, you know, she started out, I mean, the story of how she even started there was she was like a waitress who was like, you know, her job was to get up on stage and literally just can sometimes. And she went from that to just being like, you know what, I actually think we should do these weird sort of abstract modern dance things. And she became this amazing choreographer. And the contemporary dance scene as well, and sort of all these venue opportunities, like the Can Can and the Pink Door, and then, you know, places like On the Boards that are doing programming that I wouldn't have known where to look for that in Chicago. I'm not saying it wasn't there, but I don't think it was. And I feel very lucky that I happened upon Seattle. Like, you know, there's no... Everything else in my life had been me, like, worrying about, like, where should I go? What should I do? What's the right next thing? What decision will get? You know, the fact that moving to Seattle was pretty much arbitrary and was, like, sort of the biggest deterrent. I just feel very lucky, and there's some sort of woo-woo sense of, you know, Seattle developed spiritualism that makes me feel like the universe is really looking out for me.
So tell me about the kind of performance that you do now. And like, because nuts to bolts are like putting together these shows. It's not just like you get up on stage and lip sync.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. See, this is like, it's right. Like this is part of it is that the language of this performance makes so much more sense to me than every time somebody asks me to talk about it. I'm like, but this is not the language skills I've developed, you know. Give me a couple months, I'll write you a cabaret as an answer to this question.
Well, yeah, you know, you've got like the 4th of July spectacular, right. And there's the wonderful Christmas show that you do,
right, Homo for the Holidays, and I'm doing my new solo show, Cosmos. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'd say What should I tell you about him? I don't know.
Well, I guess you just you get up and you entertain people. Like, but who is the person like you're there on stage? Like, the culmination of all this performance that you've done.
Right.
When you're up there, who's that persona?
I feel like now I've been operating as this separate human for so long that there's an understanding of her that's deeper than for a long time. I sort of had sort of superficial ideas about who she was, and then I was like, well, I need to push this further, like, where's she from, what's her family like, all these things, and that kind of led to a lot of dead ends. And now I feel like I've come to some more abstract ideas about what that character means to me, and sort of a intuitive sense of there's an internal logic here, same as all those other things, same as the way that, you know, Pee-wee's running the playhouse. I can trust that she actually knows the rules, even if I don't as the artist. You know what I mean? Like, if I like stop and I listen to what should happen next, like, I can't quite explain the logic of some of the things that I put on stage, but I can feel it. You know, there's like, there's something about her that means, like, in the context of Cosmos, that she can both understand quantum mechanics fully and not know anything about science. Like, mm-hmm. those things can happen and be logical. And, you know, she can have the power to travel through space and time if she wants. And then she can also be completely baffled as to how to use a chemistry set. You know, it can all coexist. So, and maybe part of this comes from being like sort of an introvert who was like a weird little kid who tinkered in my room all the time, but that's a good portion of where the artistry lies. Like, the performance is part of it, but the development and craft of it is equally, if not more, important to me.
Do you feel like today you're more introverted or less introverted than you were when you started out performing?
I feel like I've really learned to maneuver well through the world, and I like being social. I like meeting people. I like connecting with people. But I've also like really figured out how to own and contain and not feel bad about the fact that I need a lot of alone time. Like, I need to, that I can't do any of that if I don't spend a great deal of time sort of just letting myself gestate. So,
because you have a lot of when you're on stage, there's a lot of personality happening. But I mean, you, like I said, there's that hostess feeling of like you're everybody's friend.
Yeah.
When you're there on the stage,
and that's something that feels really important to me, and it's something that's really magical about that sense of like there's something magical and unreal about it. Like, you can't expect that of another human. If you do, you're in like a bad relationship and you need to figure out how to diversify. But there's this kind of all forgiving, all loving kind of acceptance is something that can only exist in this really like special constructed world. And so that way in which the, you know, this character could never be real for so many reasons. That's one of the reasons she could never be real. And that's part of what I love about that heightened persona. Mm-hmm. And it's part of what I really value about the separation between the two. Like, I can perform that function, right? It's like being a sex worker where you can like provide like a really, you know, like maybe a really needed service for somebody that is maybe not realistic to ask from like a human, but it's contained in this fantasy. And then you can go away and be a real person and recharge. And then there's something very nourishing about being able to give that.
Mm-hmm. It's like
it was a really complicated explanation.
It's like if Bugs Bunny, like after he's done fucking around with Elmer Fudd, like goes back down into the rabbit hole and takes off his ears and cracks open a beer and slumps down on the couch. And he's like, oh, fuck, another day.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like this kind of manifested character allows you to do that, right? Like, I mean, Paul Rubens is not Pee-wee Herman. Pee-wee Herman can give us so much. I would never ask that of Paul Rubens.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Do you feel like you have a relationship with your persona?
I do. Yeah. No, I strongly do. And I think that's part of the sort of more nuanced version of what I understand about her now than, you know, as I said sort of before, I had this idea of like, oh, I need to understand like where she came from and who her family is and where she lived and what she likes to eat, you know.
But we don't know that stuff about Bugs.
Right. You know? Well, part of what actually helped it solidify was going on Drag Race, because I didn't know going in what I was going to do about the fact that I'm not her and she's not me. All I knew was that I had to stick to my guns about it. You know, I knew that if I am not in my character when I'm in my character, it won't be a representation of what I want to do on stage and what I love to do, and the art practice that I went on Drag Race so that I could share more. I mean, I went on that show so that I could do what I do more. And so I knew I had to set people up to know what they were going to see if they came to see me live. But it was so hard to maintain that persona in that world. And I was critiqued for it and sort of, you know, pressured to break it. You know, I think, and I wasn't shocked that that happened. You know, I knew going into it, part of why I resisted going on Drag Race for a while was because this idea of anonymity allows that magical mother princess, like fantasy figure, to be more real, you know? You don't want to see Minnie Mouse take her head off in Disneyland.
Right,
you know?
Right. It's behind the curtain of the Wizard of Oz.
Right.
Yeah.
So, so after that happened, it was really, like, I had to suddenly start to think about this and start to think about the fact that anybody knew who I was as a boy and what did that do? How did that, you know, how did that relate to what I was doing on stage? So my understanding of who she was started to be more about my relationship to her and what purposes she served rather than, like, I was like, oh, she doesn't need to be real. She doesn't need to have any sort of backstory. She can be a manifestation of emotions. She can be whatever fills a void of that needs filling in a sort of social sense. She can be, she can serve whatever purpose she needs to, and that can be the through line, you know?
Did she come out of Drag Race a changed woman?
I would say not in the process of Drag Race, but in the years since. Mm. Both having her interact with people. I mean, I'm in persona when I'm her. And so when I'm in these clubs and I'm like doing meet and greets with people who fell in love with this boy they think they know from TV, you know, that was an interesting thing to navigate because I was like, I was willing to go on the show and do this, but he's private, you know, like there's only a certain amount I want to share, and having boundaries around that is like part of this practice for me. But so I had to learn how she could have a relationship with him and vice versa, like how she could recognize his existence and not deny it, which is what I would have done earlier.
Like, what is she like? Oh, he's my agent?
Or? I've essentially decided that they acknowledge that they share the same body, or she acknowledges that they share the same body. But I think of it a little bit about like possession or like werewolf or like Jekyll and Hyde. Like, it's this idea of the two different personas that share one body and can share certain memories, but don't need to. I mean, you know, like, I've actually, like, been really into, there was a little while when I was trying to work up a web series that would be sort of this heightened idea of my daily life versus Dela, and it would be sort of a werewolf transformation that, like, certain things would trigger it. And, you know, and however I was filmed would be sort of like bleak and hyper realistic. And then all of her scenes would be like cartoons. And then, I think she started to develop self-aware. I mean, in my first solo show that I did, it was a sort of autobiographical piece that in it, she starts to acknowledge this thing. She's like really resentful of the fact that this boy is starting to steal her spotlight. And she, over the course of the show, goes from sort of denying it and trying to repress it more to seeing the value in it and seeing the value in that relationship and what both of those entities do for each other, you know, in a sort of more universal sense, trying to kind of talk about this idea of the things that we sometimes develop as defense mechanisms. I think there's shame and around them, that they're somehow something that's like false or something that is, you know, if you've developed a persona that you needed to in order to get rid of or to try to get away from a darker part of you, that's not just a bad thing. There's beauty in that. Like, the fact that it's artifice doesn't make it not true.
It sounds like there's actually sort of three of you. There's Dela on stage, there's Ben, as people know Ben from Drag Race, and then there's actual This Is My Private Life Ben.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, I mean, and that was a really interesting thing too, was being like, I mean, you're edited for TV. You're totally
your character.
Your boy is a character too.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I was like, I didn't go into Drag Race just bleh, letting it all hang out. Right. Going to Drag Race, like, I'm here for, like, sort of professional reasons, and I'm going to conduct myself professionally, you know? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. So what was your strategy? Like, what was your intent with Drag Race? And do you feel like it was, like, you met that goal?
Yeah. I didn't have necessarily a game plan for, I didn't have any sort of plan for winning this game. I don't think you can have a plan for winning that game. It's, there's a lot of factors. I went in wanting to get as far as I could and represent myself in a way that I would feel good about. And those were my goals. So I knew going into it that I was gonna, like, really try to temper any sort of, you know, I didn't want to feed that idea of negativity around the people. Like, I, before I went, I was like, okay, as soon as I get there, when I get into the workroom and I meet all the queens, I'm going to figure out what I like about all of them. I'm going to, you know, I mean, that I was just like, I'm going to figure out how to like all of these people and compete in this competition with them and not be pitted against them.
How's it going working with Dayla?
We're working together as much as positive and negative can, you know, but no. No, wait a minute. We're very magnetic. Opposites do attract. So
are you opposites? I don't think we are.
I think we have different working styles, but
all right.
And I also knew that I was going to really, you know, stick to maintaining the integrity of my character and not, I knew they were going to try to get me to drop it, and I just wasn't going to do it. You know, I was like,
and what would that even look like? Do you mean like you'd like fall out of character during a performance, or?
Just, I mean, like, you know, the thing is that to me, the performance is not contained to the time that I'm on stage doing something. A lot of my ideas about this stuff stem from when I was going to the Art Institute and I was studying performance artists, where the boundaries of what your performance is are non-traditional. So I just knew that I didn't want to be Minnie Mouse taking off her head, you know, like I wanted to always be in that character. So when I went on Drag Race, I was just not going to speak like this. I wasn't going to use this voice and talk in this way there when I was dressed in drag. And there's a lot of time you're dressed in drag that you're just like hanging out in a room. Right. You're just like stuck waiting for producers to say go. You know, I mean, there's, you know, there's lots of times where you're not given a lot to work with, but I was like, I'm going to maintain this thing. Cause it's a mode of thinking. Like, it's mm-hmm. like, I feel like when I'm in that zone, what first occurs to me to say in response to something is different from what would first occur to me to say in response right now. And so maintaining that was important to me. Yeah. And they hated it. They hated it. Oh my God. They wanted me to stop so badly. They really just, and it just didn't make sense to me because I didn't go on there for people to be like, oh, I like this person that was on TV. I went on Drag Race to put Dayla out there more, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of, I've forgotten the name, but the character that Andy Kaufman did of the lounge singer.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, you just like to the point where people just didn't know, is that actually Andy or is that right. just some guy?
Yeah, exactly. I feel like there's a lot of performance history in that realm and it's exciting to me. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily the things that reality TV are made out of.
Right.
I mean, this
right.
idea of reality.
Right. Well, it's going to be their reality. I mean, we're going to be fabricating. It's not real, but right. we want to be the ones fabricating
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, it's so goofy that there's somehow going to, like, you know, this highly edited, super stylized thing is somehow, quote unquote, revealing, you yeah. know, truth. You know, and in some senses it does, but, you know, and that's, to say that is not, you know, I don't mean to be disparaging in that because that is my favorite thing. I love to use artifice to reveal truth, you know, mm-hmm. so it's just the idea of proclaiming something objectively true feels inherently false. Mm.
since Drag Race, I mean, that kind of put you on the map for a lot of folks. A lot of your audience now knows you from that. So that's led to a lot of opportunities that you wouldn't have otherwise had. So you've had, I know you've got Cosmos, you did New York.
Yeah.
And so where can folks find the show or connect with you?
Go to bedlocrem.com. Look at my calendar.
Well, Ben and all the Bens that you have brought with you, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to Ben for joining me. Though theaters are currently closed, I cannot recommend Ben's live appearances highly enough. And when we can all go back out and spend time together, you absolutely must make it a priority to seek out the wild, zany, colorful character that he's created. There is nothing quite like seeing Dale alive, and the only word I can think of to sum up the experience is romp. The character creates a bizarre alternate universe in the theater that grabs hold of you, pulls you in, and enchants you to the point that you're not sure why you would ever want to leave. That's why, for my recommendation this week, I'd like you to check out another gender trickster, David Bowie, as the Goblin King Jareth in Labyrinth. I hope you've seen this film, but if not, a quick synopsis. The otherworldly Jareth seduces young Sarah into a magical kingdom where none of the rules of everyday life apply, and to reach the center of the labyrinth, she must master the bizarre rules of a fantasy realm. A couple of years ago, I went to a Q&A with some of the Muppet performers in the film, and one of them described the movie as having a lot of space. I think that's a fair critique, and not necessarily a criticism. Like the labyrinth itself, the movie leaves you with plenty of mysteries and obscured connections to puzzle out on your own. It's an invitation to use your imagination, to fill in gaps, and wonder what was real. And that's what the best trickster characters do, whether it's Bugs Bunny or Jareth or Loki or Groucho Marx or Ben de la Creme. Spend a little time in their weird upside-down worlds, and you'll start to pick up a little of their magic yourself. Then once you're back out in the real world, you can always recharge your imagination by calling on a little of that magic that you picked up. You know, should you need it. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get some backer rewards. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com, and join us for the next live stream on September 25th at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link at the top of The Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Check out my YouTube series Culture Cruise for detailed explorations of queer milestones on TV and film, and subscribe to my podcasts Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two comedy adventure shows featuring drag heroes in a world of fantasy. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Comtech.com. Listen to the Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.